Next case, which is Farrell v. Astru. Ms. Owen. Are you Mr. Owen?
I am, sir.
Okay. Sorry.
It's all right. It's a common mistake. I am Gene Owen, a member of the Kansas Bar here representing the appellant, Jacqueline Guidry, who is with me on the brief, is seated at the council table. Our client, Your Honor, is basically, she was 36 years of age at the time of the administrative hearing in 2008, with an alleged disability onset date of November 4th, 2003. She had 2.5 to 3 years of college education. I really won't go into her past relevant work, as the ALJ found that it was that she could not go back and do that past relevant work. Her impairments consisted of both physical and mental limitations. Degenerative disc disease of the lumbar spine, inflammatory arthritis, obesity, fibromyalgia, major depression disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, and personality disorder. We alleged basically four issues of error. The first one we cited was that the ALJ erred in failing to consider the combined effect of all of plaintiff's impairments, specifically fibromyalgia, which, interestingly enough, he found was not a severe impairment.
But at that stage, the only thing, this is your step two argument, if I'm recalling, that just keeps you on track. You know, and later on, when the ALJ is making a more comprehensive determination of residual functional capacity and the step five inquiry, he factors the fibromyalgia back in. So I'm not sure I understand why you think that in and of itself is so important. I wonder if you could tell me, though, whether you are somehow assigning error to the Appeals Council's decision not to do anything when you finally submitted, or when it was finally available, Dr. Lloyd's diagnosis of the fibromyalgia using all these different points.
Yes, we are assigning error to the Appeals Council decision.
And how are we supposed to do that? Do you think the Appeals Council had some duty to write an opinion, or do you think that just means that this evidence is in the record and we can look at it? Or I'm not sure what you want us to do with that.
Well, what I want you to do with it, Your Honor, is review it, because it's incumbent upon the appellate courts to review that evidence.
But how do we know the Appeals Council didn't look at it and just say, well, we're not impressed?
Well, there's an obligation for the Appeals Council to weigh new and material evidence to determine if it could change, it could have a material impact and change the ALJ's decision. Now, there's no indication from what we can tell that the Appeals Council did weigh the evidence.
It's just one of those boilerplate orders, right?
So yeah, we don't know what they did. They basically entered the boilerplate sentence to the effect that it wouldn't change the outcome of the ALJ's decision. Well, under those circumstances, it's as if they were saying, all right, we're going to find this immaterial. Under those circumstances, I think Scively comes into play, Your Honor, and that's a case that was decided by this court. And basically what Scively, as we interpret Scively, it's saying when the Appeals Council finds that subsequently submitted evidence is immaterial, it should review that evidence to see if that's the case.
A law judge make a credibility finding which really destroys her case?
Well, no, Your Honor. Credibility, to me, is basically a very minimal issue here when you look at the evidence that was submitted to the appeals council.
I didn't think that because he just seemed to think that she was much better, much abler to function than she said. She said that didn't find the claimant fully credible as far as her denial of any type of involvement in the care of her two children. Taking care of her family before herself and babysitting her husband round the clock when he had some psychological problem. Treatment, just outpatient counseling. I just think he didn't find her believable. This, the type of problems she has, they can be more or less severe. And if he doesn't think they're severe and it's not contrary to the medical evidence, why wouldn't that be decisive?
Quite frankly, Your Honor, we did not feel that he gave adequate support to find that she was not credible, but that really, as far as we're concerned, begs the issue of the appeals counsel's failure to weigh the new and material evidence, which in turn rebutted what the medical expert...
How did the new evidence rebut his credibility findings?
Well, because basically he wasn't even considering fibromyalgia, Your Honor, and he's required... He's required under the applicable regulations to weigh a combination of impairments.
It varies in severity, right?
The fibromyalgia?
Yeah.
Well,
you can have fibromyalgia but still be able to work.
That would be true. I would assume under some circumstances.
Just looking at her. Listening to her testimony and looking at the other evidence, if he just concludes she can work, why is it critical whether she has fibromyalgia?
Well, because it was a severe impairment. A judge in an earlier hearing found it was a severe impairment, and the only reason this judge didn't was because he had a medical expert that said, oh, I don't see anything here that indicates the requisite 11 of 18 tender trigger points. What happens, though, is the doctors, especially the treating physician, Dr. Beyer, had not pointed to the numerical trigger points. She just said multiple trigger points are positive.
And that's what Dr. Lloyd fills in. You're talking about page five.
That's exactly right. Now, what happens here is the administrative law judge ignores fibromyalgia altogether. Is not considered in combination with the other impairments as he was required to do by the commissioner's applicable regulations.
But he also says even if he were to accept the diagnosis, there's no indication that this condition has caused more than minimal functional limitations. The claimant reported significant improvement in the severity of her symptoms following treatment with medication.
I understand that he made that finding, but the fact is he did not accept the diagnosis. He did not consider it. Now, with regard to the fact that he's saying that there was reported significant improvement, the record indicates otherwise. Dr. Beyer's office notes of January 2006 show multiple symptoms with fibromyalgia continuing. Additionally, during a hospital stay in September 2007 into October 2008, she complained of lots of fibromyalgia pain. As of October 7th, It was reported she was taking multiple medications for fibromyalgia, and then we turn around and have the actual numbers. The Dr. Lloyd finding that there was 18 of 18 positive trigger points, and then a month or so later, 16 of 18 positive trigger points. What we're trying to say is fibromyalgia should not have been taken out of the equation here.
So are you saying that it should have been that some functional limitation flowing from the fibromyalgia should have been part of the RFC?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The ALJ was required to consider a combination of impairments, and it does not appear that he considered the fibromyalgia in doing so. The second issue that we argued was that the ALJ erred in assessing the RFC on really a number of fronts, not just by ignoring the fibromyalgia. The RFC must be based upon all the evidence evidence in the case record, medically determinable impairments that are not severe. As with the issue of the combined impairments, the ALJ failed to follow the treating physician rule, ignoring substantive findings of the treating physician, Dr. Beyer, and relying on the testimony of Dr. Boyce, the non-examining medical expert who appeared at the hearing, using the non-examining physician's opinions to discredit Dr. Byers, a treating physician, was contrary to the commissioner's
but
regulation.
But remember what Judge Woods said. The administrative law judge said that even if he were to accept the diagnosis of fibromyalgia, there's no indication that this condition has caused more than minimal functional limitations. Isn't that what you have to focus on? Because that is, don't you have to focus on his findings with regard to her functional limitations? If he's right that she can work, it really doesn't matter what she has.
I understand, and he's stating a conclusion, Your Honor, which we believe.
But I'm saying to you, don't you have to focus on her functional limitations? Did he underestimate those limitations?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it.
Well, be specific.
Okay.
What limitation did he fail to consider?
Okay. We believe that he did not consider or adequately consider her hand limitations. We certainly believe he did not adequately consider her mental limitations. He simply suggested that the claimant's general mental limitation was that she was restricted to jobs which where she could only do simple repetitive skills. Now, this is part of an alarming trend where these ALJs simply gloss over the very specific mental limitations such as we had here, and which were identified by the state agency non-examining medical physicians, which the ALJ said supported the testimony of Dr. Thomas, the ME who appeared at the hearing and testified regarding the
mental... What's the problem
with her hand? Inflammatory arthritis, Your Honor.
Well, how does it manifest itself?
With significant pain in the joints of the fingers as well as in the wrists. If you look at
did the administrative law judge fail to realize that or what?
Well, there's really not any indication that he took into consideration The findings of Dr. Kashif, those are the transcript.
Well, is the pain so acute that she can't use her hand, or what?
Well, Dr. Meyer, her treating physician, Your Honor, said that she could only occasionally use her hands. Dr. Kashif said that she had positive paraarticular tenderness in the joints of her hands and wrists bilaterally. It was of further significance that the ALJ found that the inflammatory arthritis was a severe impairment, yet still found she was able to use her hands frequently. That's because that's what the ME was saying, contrary to what Dr. Beyer, the treating physician, was saying, in that she could only use her hands occasionally. The other problem that we have here is the failure of the ALJ to address the specific mental limitations, which the state agency, there were seven of them, which the state agency identified. He just tried to lump them.
Your time has expired. Hear from Ms. Swisher.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Diana Ansayer, and I represent the Commissioner of Social Security. I'd very much like to address what the appellant said about how this Court should review the additional evidence presented in the first instance to the Appeals Council. That is not the case. Under Section 405G of the United States statutes, this Court may not review evidence in the first instance. That is the agency's role.
Do we know the agency really took a look at this new final confirmed diagnosis of the fibromyalgia?
The Appeals Council stated that it considered the new evidence.
It's a pretty weak statement. But actually what I was interested in is my biggest concern about this case is that the administrative law judge seemed to have done quite a bit of cherry-picking of the records of the medical evidence. He mentions that one time that she manages to get a GAF score of 60, but there's some 60 pages of medical evidence detailing the fact that that was actually rather unusual. Her GAF score went all the way down into the 40s, 43, 50. She was frequently shown to be markedly impaired from a mental health point of view, and if you're curled up in a little ball in your house, I mean, you're not working every day of the month. So I don't see any grappling with the array of evidence. All you see is just this one sunny moment, you know, when she managed to get up to 60.
Judge, I think it's important to keep in mind that the ALJ did rely on the testimony of the psychological expert who was aware of plaintiff's EBS. It is true. The record shows she goes up and down, she goes up and down.
And she goes way down. I mean, I don't see where the judge himself, to get back to the point that Judge Posner was making, is thinking about how these ebbs and flows are going to affect her functional capacity to work. If she's good 3 weeks out of the month and bad 5 working days out of the month, every VE that I've ever seen would say that she couldn't hold down a job. They usually say 3 days regular absence is too much.
Although the ALJ may not specifically have addressed each instance of her various levels of GAF scores, the fact remains that he did explicitly state that he relied on the psychological expert's testimony, which as a whole accounted for the entire picture of her impairments.
I'm just not sure that's enough. But anyway, I mean, if that's the best you have, that's the best you have. He says there's a couple of psychiatric hospitalizations, but I just don't see actually a real discussion of these GAF scores and how low they do get. I'm remembering.
Again, I do think that's encompassed in the psychological expert's testimony. The ALJ does not need to mention every single piece of evidence in the
record.
Well,
I know, but there has to be a fair engagement with the array of evidence. You can't just pick the evidence that's going to favor you and ignore all the rest of it.
I don't necessarily agree that the ALJ cherry-picked only the good evidence. As you stated, there is some negative evidence in here that she has difficulties. The ALJ does acknowledge that she has some limitations. It's not a sunny shine gloss on her medical record. There is acknowledgement of some lows.
Mm-hmm. But their functional significance is what I'm worried about, because even if she had a lot of good days in a month where she really was able to work in this very sanitized environment that the ALJ describes, with no encounters with the public and very simple work and all the rest of it, some of which are addressing one part and some of which another, if the psychological impairment is going to keep her away from work 3 days a month, she can't work.
Judge, the bottom line remains that the ALJ relied on 4 medical experts, psychological experts, to find that despite the evidence of her lows and ebbs, she was able to maintain the performance of simple and repetitive tasks with limited social contact. And to your point I don't necessarily agree that that's a very sanitized environment. I believe the VE testified that there were over 17,000 jobs in Indiana alone. I don't think that's going to be an unusual situation for those findings.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I noticed that the date of the administrative law judge's opinion, and I guess this was after a remand, is 3.5 years ago. Is there some reason for such extraordinary delay?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. It may be the case, and the appellant can correct me if I'm wrong, that there was an extension sought before the appeals counsel, but I'm not entirely sure of that. I would have to check the record. If the court has no further questions, I'd like to return to the point about the evidence before the appeals counsel. The bottom line regarding that evidence is, as the court noted, it contained only a diagnosis. It did not contain additional functional limitations. And the fact is, the ALJ accounted for the diagnosis or lack thereof in a severity finding. He explicitly stated, even if the plaintiff had a diagnosis, there are no more than minimal functional limitations. Therefore, even if the evidence were reviewable in the first instance by this court, which we do not agree that it is, it's completely immaterial to the ALJ's determination. Now, moving on to the appellant's mental impairments, I would also like to discuss that. In the first instance, I would say that the appellant has waived this argument by not presenting to the district court. Waiver is a deliberate choice. But I think it's worth noting that O'Connor Spinner came out in November 2010. The appellant filed her brief in district court in January 2011. Her counsel was a very experienced social security litigator, and this case made news, O'Connor Spinner. Therefore, I think it's a reasonable assumption that it was a deliberate choice on the part of her counsel before the district court not to present this argument. However, even if this is forfeiture and not waiver, forfeiture requires plain error that is clear and obvious. Because O'Connor Spinner did not institute a per se rule, there is no clear and obvious error. Moving on to the actual, if O'Connor Spinner is controlling in this instance, I would like to point out that this court has said where there is manifest evidence supporting the conclusion that the specific limitations would account for the plaintiff's impairments, then the hypothetical is reasonable and should be affirmed. Here, there's manifest evidence. There are 4 psychological experts who specifically state someone with moderate limitations in concentration, persistence, and pace, as was found here, can perform simple and repetitive tasks with limited social contact. That is what the ALJ relied on. That is manifest evidence that the question to the VE was reasonable and should be affirmed. Those are the 2 points I wanted to cover. If the court has
Ms.
no further
Fisher, questions. One of the things that gives me some pause is this reliance on Dr. Boyce over Breyer. Do you have any comment about that, considering the depth of Breyer's examination versus the non-examination capacity?
I do.
Inherent in Boyce.
Yes. 2 points, Your Honor. One is that Dr. Boyce reviewed the entire medical record at a more recent point in time, 2008, at the date of the hearing, whereas Dr. Byers' assessments were in 2005. In addition, the ALJ reasonably discounted Dr. Beyer's assessment and identified several reasons for doing so. Dr. Beyer did not identify specific clinical findings for her functional limitations. In addition, it was inconsistent with the medical record, which, for example, she had several severe physical postural limitations, but Dr. Beyer's treatment notes from the same day showed that she had a normal walk, normal range of motion, and full strength in her joints. For those two reasons, I think it's reasonable for the ALJ to have adopted Dr. Boyce's opinion over Dr. Beyer's. If the court has no further questions, I would...
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Swisher. So, Mr. Owen, your time expired, but we'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. As far as Judge Wood's question, the plaintiff's GAF actually went down to as low as 30. I think it's important to realize that the ALJ really failed to reference most of the plaintiff's global assessment functioning scores, which fell into the range of 30 to 50, indicating a serious impairment in social, occupational, and school functionings, which was obviously compromise her ability to work. With regard to the ALJ throwing water on Dr. Beyer's findings because she didn't indicate specific clinical findings, it's almost like the ALJ is trying to create a new legal standard here. Because what we have generally, the general rule of law is that If the treating physician's findings are supported by medical evidence in the case record, then you should give the treating physician's opinion either controlling or significant weight. The findings were supported. The findings of Dr. Beyer were supported in the record. She should not have been able to. You know, doctors don't come in and do records. Do medical records with the idea that there's going to be litigation that these records will be the basis for. They do so to remind themselves of the patient's impairments and inform other doctors of what's going on with the patient.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Owen and Ms. Fisher.